Parisian. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOC 105.3 FM Troy and WOOS 98.9 FM Schenectady, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm Chris Scully.
And I'm Amy Loria. Today, correspondent Dave Pueblo talks about the Green New Deal with panelist Howie Hawkins at an event this weekend at Albany Public Library.
Then, Erin Pedinati interviews activist Dee Dee Halleck about her case against public access television provider Manhattan Neighborhood Network.
Later on, we have a live interview with Barbara Heinzen about the town of Queeman's Local Law No. 1 Clean Air Bill.
After the interview, we hear the final segment on the public hearings from the Climate and Community Protection Act.
We will conclude today's piece with a tribute to local iconic singer Caroline Mother Judge Isaacson, who passed away this week. Some say it's never too cold for ice cream, especially over at the Snowman. Troy's beloved ice cream shop opened their windows at 11 a.m. Saturday morning. It is their 66th year, serving up sundaes, banana splits, flurries, shakes, and brownie royals. It's nice to go someplace that is local, that is not part of a huge chain. It's from us here. It's from Troy, and any ice cream place in Troy belongs to the whole capital region, said Lois Pownall. The Snowman is open Saturday through Wednesday from 11 a.m. to 9 p.m., and on Sundays they open at noon.
For 100 years, Sage College's Troy campus has primarily educated women, but next year it will become co-educational. Currently, our male students can already take classes there, so it's not a dramatic change. But it's a real change, explained Christopher Ames, president of Sage Colleges. Enrollment at the college's Troy campus has declined. Quote, one of the things we learned was that 98% of young women graduating from high school say they aren't interested in a women's college, unquote. So it's not about attracting men. It's about attracting women who might not give us as close a look as they should. The school is also rebranding its name to Russell Sage College with campuses in Albany and Troy. We're really focusing on the idea that we are one single campus, which we are, said Ames. The school will maintain its dedication to feminism by creating a new women's studies new women's institute. The college will officially become co-ed in 2020.
After 13 seasons anchored off of Hudson Shores Park in Watervliet, the Rusty Anchor Restaurant Barge will not reopen this year. During heavy ice flows on the Hudson River in January, the barge was among several vessels that broke free from their moorings and floated downriver, crashing into the Livingston Avenue Railway Bridge. Rusty Anchor owner Kevin Schuflet tells Rulison damage to the barge was too extensive to be worth repairing and it will be scrapped. He would not say whether he plans to reopen another waterfront restaurant.
Citing her opposition to the city's trash fee, City Council President Carmela Montello said Thursday night she would seek a public referendum on whether the fee should be abolished. As I've stated many times, while the administration states finances are better, much of that burden has been shifted to the taxpayers through taxes and fees. One example is the garbage fee. I personally oppose this fee as it's just another tax, Montello said.
It's that time of year again. Freezing temperatures continue to pose challenges for local roads. Water inside pavement freezes, causing road surfaces to crack and allowing potholes to form. The freeze-thaw cycle experienced across the Northeast creates headaches for drivers and cities alike. The city's pothole repair teams are deployed throughout most of the year to fill in potholes in neighborhoods across Troy. If you see crews working in your neighborhood, please slow down to ensure their safety. Furthermore, let them know about any potholes you may see. Pothole report form is available at www.troyny.gov/departments/public-works/pothole-reporting-form.
The next American Idol could be from the Capital Region. Last night during the audition round of American Idol, 16-year-old Madison Vanderberg from Cohoes received a standing ovation from all three judges. While it's still very early in the competition, Madison wowed the judges and earned a trip to Hollywood. For those just tuning in, you're listening to Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network, coming to you from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy.
To learn more about this program and the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or warm regards, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Howie Hawkins was one of several panelists at a public meeting about the Green New Deal on Saturday, March 9, 2019, at the Albany Public Library. With so many well-vetted indications that climate change is an immediate existential threat, Hawkins made specific proposals on what can be done in New York State.
Okay, so this is Dave Pueblo, and I'm at a meeting regarding the Green New Deal happening at the Albany Public Library today on Saturday, March 9th, and I'm standing with Howie Hawkins. Howie, tell our listeners basically who you are.
Well, I was a Green Party candidate for governor in 2010, 2014, and 2018, and the theme of all three of those campaigns was a Green New Deal for New York, which is a combination of an economic bill of rights for things like universal health care, the New York Health Act, jobs, education, housing, and 100% clean energy by 2030, which would be the economic stimulus and sustainable economic foundation for all the economic rights and security that people need.
One of the things that has come up as a consistent theme at meetings like this that I've been to is the entire thing can seem enormous and abstract, especially on a local or regional level. Do you have specific things that you could recommend for people to do to try and advance the Green New Deal or similar projects?
Well, we have legislation before the state legislature. On the health care piece, it's the New York Health Act. On the climate piece, it's called New York Off Fossil Fuels. It's a plan to get us to 100% clean energy by 2030, which is what the climate science says developed countries like or states like New York need to do in order to avert dangerous climate change. And so right now the state legislature is considering climate action. Unfortunately, it looks like Cuomo, who has taken the Green New Deal brand and used it to cover for flooding the states with frack gas power plants and subsidies for nuclear power, along with some, you know, solar electricity and wind power. And that is not adequate to what the climate science says we need to do. So at this point, right now, people need to be talking to their legislators and organizing demonstrations, all kinds of activity to get the legislature to do what we need to do and make the demands. So I think right now in New York, you know, I like to call it the Archimedes lever. You know, Archimedes, the old Greek, said if you give me the right lever and the lever point, I can move the world. New York is the 11th largest economy in the world if it was a nation, and we're a media capital, a financial capital. What we do matters, and we can lead the nation and the world, show them that it's technically feasible to go to clean energy by 2030, and it would be an economic benefit for everybody in the state. And other states and nations will want to follow once we demonstrate it.
I know from past experience as an activist and a quasi-lobbyist that when you're dealing with a powerful entity like Governor Cuomo and he has a specific plan that he's trying to advance, when you're approaching your assembly or senator representatives one by one, it can be very difficult, and you need to have specifics that you can suggest in place of what the governor is trying to get through. Do you have that type of information listed online for people to have access to so that they can go in armed with information to ask the right asks?
Yeah, the New York Off Fossil Fuels Act is online. You can get it at the State Assembly. You can read that. The Green Education and Legal Fund has a good summary of the bill and the arguments for it, the talking points. Food and Water Watch does as well. That'll give you the information you need to lobby for that bill. And you're right, lobbying can be frustrating. Some legislators, or you sometimes get to a legislative aide, will actually listen to what you're saying and will ask for more information. And others will like smile and nod and won't do anything. What sometimes moves them, and more often moves them, is a mass movement. That's how we got the ban on fracking. You know, I campaigned that in 2010 when very few were, and by 2014, we had a mass movement, and Cuomo, every indication was he wanted to go ahead with fracking. I mean, right before the election, he was trying to poo-poo a study that said it would contaminate the water. He, like, wanted it redone. And then after the election, we got 5%. Zephyr Teachout got 35% in the Democratic primary, and our vote totals were about the same. And I think Governor Cuomo said, oh my God, I lost a lot of votes. I wanted more votes than I got last time. I got less. And it went to this challenge, and the fracking demand was one of our leading demands. And so we moved him. Unfortunately, now he's importing frack gas and building pipelines and power plants. So we got to, you know, stay on it and this time push for the New York Off Fossil Fuels Act, I think, is what we need to focus on right now. And what I said during the campaign, and I still say, is the climate, safe climate movement, the environmental movement, the economic justice movement need to focus on this New York Off Fossil Fuels Act with the same laser focus we had on the ban on fracking 4 years ago. And if we don't get it passed this year, we need to keep pushing because we're running out of time with the climate.
So far our conversation has been focused primarily on legislation issues, but what are other things that people can do in terms of reaching out to local or national or international business forces or other entities that they can push in the direction that we need to go so that they can in turn influence the legislative debate?
Well, I think public policy is the best way to move business. If we pass a carbon tax, it will give predictable price signals as to when the payback time is if you install renewable energy on your business. And the same for consumers on their homes. And so I think that's the kind of incentive. It, you know, business is out to make money, and they'll make money based on what the market is telling them to do. And right now it's telling them natural gas is cheaper than renewables, at least for the time being, so they're going with natural gas. The businesses that do natural gas, they know how to build those plants. They don't want to get into, you know, the same kind of construction would be involved in concentrated solar power, where you have a lot of mirrors. It boils water based on the reflection of those mirrors. So it's the same principle. Same goes with the building trades that are involved in fossil fuels, like boilermakers. You know, I've talked to those guys. Yeah, we like things that burn. Well, actually, you're going to need a boiler for a concentrated solar panel plant. So we got to show people that there are alternatives. The Boilermakers actually on their, you know, National Union website highlight a boiler, concentrated solar power boiler that they're building in the Mojave Desert. So I think it's partly education and partly public policy that gives them the right incentives.
Okay, and any other points that you want to make that I haven't, brought up?
Well, we face an existential threat. The headline is the special report from the International Panel on Climate Change. The headlines say we have 12 years. What it actually meant was we have 12 years in their estimation to get a cut of carbon emissions 45% below 2010 levels and then get totally decarbonized by 2050. I actually believe that's too slow. The International Panel on Climate Change tends to be more conservative than the science indicates because they got to get those reports passed. Petrostates and the big carbon emitters like the U.S., Russia, China, Saudi Arabia. So they're always underestimating the pace at which global warming is happening and understating what we need to do about it. But even that is an ambitious timeline. And so if we don't do that, the consequences are deadly. Dangerous climate change, 2 degrees and above. This report was trying to keep us at 1.5 degrees. Means mass extinctions, ecosystem collapse, collapse of food production, social conflict and wars as we're mass impoverished, huge environmental migrations. It's a, you know, science fiction movie kind of picture. And that's by 2050. By 2100, if we keep putting carbon in the atmosphere, which then goes into the ocean as carbonic acid, phytoplankton, which provide 2/3 of the oxygen in the atmosphere, will die off. We'll suffocate. I mean, we're really on the edge of an existential threat. So people need to, like, act like that and not be hopeless. I mean, if we can build out this clean energy system, it's going to be an economic boon, and we can have a good standard of living. But if we sit on our haunches, we're in for big trouble.
And just to close, for people to get access to this information that you've talked about online, where would they go?
Well, I think the Green Education and Legal Fund, the Food and Water Watch that I mentioned are good sources. My webpage, howiehawkins.org, has a lot of material from my campaign about these issues. you know, media statements, policy papers, and links to more. For example, my written testimony, if you want to go over to climate science, I tried to review it for these senators who really haven't paid attention and, you know, tried to point out how dire it is. And it links there to the, you know, peer-reviewed scientific papers as well as some popular accounts. So there's a lot of information on my website, too.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hello again,
everyone. This is H. Bosch Jr.
Now is correspondent Dave Pavlo speaking with Howie Hawkins of the Green Party at Saturday's public meeting in Albany about the Green New Deal.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM Troy and WOOS 98.9 FM Schenectady. In our next segment, we play part one of WOOC correspondent Aaron Pettinati's interview with Dee Dee Halleck, a media activist and founder of Paper Tiger Television and Deep Dish Satellite Network, about the First Amendment case that she and New Yorkian poet Jesus Papiloto Melendez are currently pursuing against the public access television provider Manhattan Neighborhood Network. In this half of the interview, Dee Dee provides her perspective on the nature of the case.
Dee Dee, thanks for joining us. It's good to have you as a guest on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. To start out, can you give us a sense of what this case is about, both in a concrete sense and at the level of constitutional principles and jurisprudence?
Well, I think that public access was made to be a public forum because when the cable companies provide their own franchise systems and networks and different ways of selling commercial television, they also have an obligation to have the local people be able to use the channels. That was always my idea of what public access is. Because in order to get to your TV set, they have to go through the city infrastructure, and that is sort of like a quid pro quo. The city opens up their manholes or their telephone poles and allows the cable company to make use of it to make their money, and in exchange they give a percentage of their profits to support community media. And that to me is a really good thing. And actually, for many years, Manhattan didn't have any studio or any infrastructure for communities. They did have a couple of channels which you had to rent a commercial studio to put your programs on. And when I first started working with Paper Tiger TV, we had to pay for each piece of equipment that we used at this commercial TV entity called Metro Access, but it was a profit-making business. And so we saw that around the country people had public access stations, so we testified in the city council and we marched and had demonstrations to say that there should be a way that local people in Manhattan could have a real studio. And so part of my own interest in MNN is a kind of proprietary thing, because it was through Paper Tiger and Fairness and Accuracy in Media and the United Church of Christ Communications Office. We actually were the people that enabled the city to get their acts together and get public access. And nowadays that has grown to be $11 million a year they get. And there was a very nice program of providing community media grants. Each year about $300,000 would be divvied out in smaller grants to community organizations. And it had a very positive purpose in the sense that it got local people and community groups the wherewithal and the training and the access to equipment to make their programs. And what alarmed me after working so hard to get the station started was the fact that they had these community media grants and they cut them out. At the same time, they raised the salary of the manager and the director so that now he's making $430,000 a year, which is way off the scale in terms of what a public access director usually makes. So we wanted to get the community media grants reinstated, so we went to a board meeting, and we were told that we couldn't go to the board meeting, that they were private. And so Papaletto and I went out and tried to go to the opening of the Firehouse, which is their satellite studio, and we just made a tape sitting outside. And because of the tape, they said we were banned. But they were really banning us because they didn't want us to go to the board meeting. It had really very little to do with the tape. And it really was tragic because Papaletto was doing so well there, and he loved working. He was so excited to have a studio in his neighborhood. He lived down the street, and he had all kinds of plans to do talent shows and poetry readings, and he couldn't have access. And I felt terrible that we had caused him to be banned and myself to be banned. So we said, this is not the way public access should be. It should be free speech. And so we sued, and we won, actually, in the U.S. Circuit Court. And we were really happy. We were thinking that we would settle, and we'd settle to reinstate the community media grants and think about doing series of programs. And we were really happy. And then they appealed. MNN appealed, saying that they were private, that public access didn't have to be a public forum. They did not want to admit that they were wrong, basically.
So it sounds like part of what's at stake in this case is the question of whether a private community media organization that receives public funds is obliged to provide First Amendment rights to people who are interested in using their facilities.
Yeah, that it's really the whole raison d'etre of having a public channel is to give people a forum. And how are you going to manage the forum? And obviously you do and it's in the New York State Public Service Commission regulations, it has to be first come, first serve, which means you can't really turn anything down. You can program different things at different times of the day or night, and you can put children's programming in the afternoon and stuff that may be sexual or whatever and content later on at night. But you have to run everything, and that was not the case in terms of how they treated our video. I mean, they said it was threatening. The video is not threatening at all. What they were threatened by was our attempt to bring up issues to the board. And the thing is, the bylaws say that they have to do that. The bylaws and their handbook says that they exist to enable residents of Manhattan to exercise their First Amendment rights. That's what it says. So they're such hypocrites that they would actually deny that when it says that in their bylaws as an organization.
And that was Aaron Pettinati interviewing Dee Dee Halleck on her First Amendment case against the Manhattan Neighborhood Network.
For those just tuning in, I'm Amy.
And I'm Chris. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network, coming to you from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York.
To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to find out about the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or a sour bone to pick, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Also, be sure to tune in 7 to 10 p.m. weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, a wonderful celebration of all that is creative, dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region. Barbara Heinzen is a long-term strategist and scenario planner with a 30-year practice working with corporations, government departments, and civil society organizations in Asia, Africa, Latin America, Europe, and the United States. In recent years, she has been working on two multi-stakeholder projects concerning the future of energy, one in East Africa and the other in Pennsylvania, USA. Barbara is also a volunteer environmental activist and advocate in the community and owns 20 acres of land along the Hudson River on the boundary of town of Queemans and New Baltimore. Barbara joins us back on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine now to talk about the town of Queemans' clean air bill. Welcome back, Barbara.
Thank you very much for having me.
So, Barbara, you've been on our show before. Can you give us a quick rundown of Local Law Number 1, Clean Air Bill, and why it's important?
Yeah, I think the last time I was here, I was talking about how it came about. Because there was in late 2017, the Connecticut Department of Environmental Protection had a proposal to send all the municipal waste from Hartford to the Lafarge plant in Queemans for burning. And they didn't tell the town of Queemans, they didn't tell Albany County, they just were quietly making their plans. And it was one of three proposals, but we heard about it just before Christmas in 2017, and a hasty news conference had the room packed in the Queemans Town Hall. That persuaded Connecticut that maybe they would not accept that proposal of the three they had before them, and they had to make a decision before the end of 2017. So our news conference was 2 days after Christmas, and by the end of the year, the proposal had died. So that was very fortunate for us.
The local law will be voted on at this Thursday's town board meeting. How would you recommend listeners who are in support of this bill get involved?
Yeah, the law came about because the person who had alerted us to this threat from Connecticut then helped the town of Queemans to write a clean air law. And that was had a public hearing last August, and then it was put up for a vote in December. There were various delays put in the way by the Lafarge company that said, well, surely it's okay to burn tires. You know, okay, we won't burn garbage, but we can burn tires. And now, after going through every possible delay and giving Lafarge as much time as possible to get their point of view across, the town has said, enough, we're going to vote on Thursday. So if you're in the neighborhood, please come along at 7 o'clock to the Queemans Town Hall at 18 Russell Avenue in Ravenna, or write to Phil Crandall at pcrandall@queemans.org and say, we support the clean air law, please pass it.
And so specifically, what would this law legislate around? Would it be a complete ban on any municipal waste burning for the purposes of energy?
It's not a complete ban. It was a little bit subtler than that because it said you can burn solid waste, municipal waste, tires, other kinds of waste, but no more than 25 tons a day, which sounds like a lot to you and me, but if you're trying to fire your cement plant, it's not enough to make a significant difference. And if you do decide to burn up to 25 tons a day, you then have to monitor the pollutants that are coming out of your smokestack on a continuous basis. And not just the four that the EPA and DEC are always asking us to monitor, but about 19 different pollutants, including dioxins and furans and other things that are not considered very safe for human life or for the environment in general. So you have whoever wants to burn waste has to monitor on a daily basis and publish their results on a regular basis online where everybody can see them in real time.
Could you speak to the kind of health risks that we would face if these contaminants and pollutants were not monitored?
That's a very good question. And when I've tried to look for the studies of burning garbage in various places, we have very few good studies that I've found on a quick search in the U.S. Most of the studies have been in places like India and other countries outside the U.S. There seems to be a higher risk of cancer. There's higher risk of respiratory diseases. One of my neighbors, whose house has been downstream of the downwind of the cement plant, was telling me yesterday that they had four or five cases of cancer in his street alone, including his son, who died of cancer before he left high school. So what I would love to see a proper epidemiological study in our neighborhood and in the downwind area of the cement plant and other places that are incinerating garbage, but they have not been done in our neck of the woods so far as I know.
So what about other towns and villages in this region? Are any of other municipalities struggling with similar types of environmental issues?
Yeah. There's a proposal to burn incinerate garbage in Glen Falls, and that's to the north of us, and that's something that people are trying to oppose. There's also a huge issue around the dump in Rensselaer that was approved, and there's some developments on that that I don't think it's incineration, but it's the management of garbage in an unsafe way, let's put it that way. There's also a request in Catskill to put fly ash from cement plants in an old quarry very close to the Hudson River. And fly ash is something that actually has a lot of toxins in it. So we don't particularly want that to go forward either. The difficulty with all of this is that where all these activist protests are closing off incineration, are closing off some of these options that we've been used to having, and we still have mountains of garbage. So there's a very big issue that we don't know how to face in this region, and I would say we don't know how to face in the country. What are we going to do with the garbage we're producing?
And what are some proposals that you may have heard, or what would be done if no direct action other than these laws was passed?
If there's no direction law against incineration, well, the incineration would go ahead. There would be limited monitoring of three or four of the pollutants, but it would go ahead. With the direct action, and if incineration is stopped, then you'll see more rubbish going into landfills. And we also have protests over expanding the landfill in the Albany Pine Bush, for example. In Queemans, we had a very big fight over taking a very large area of wetlands and turning that into a dump for the city of Albany. That was defeated. So we're running out of landfill that people are willing to have as landfill. The option of incineration is being closed off. So what do we do about the garbage that our society produces? One possibility is, well, let's not produce so much garbage. You know, how do you just not create the amount of packaging? Or how do you create packaging that can be composted rather than burnt? So that's one option. How do you do that? With something like tires, how do you reuse them in a safe way? How do you grind them up, and can you then use them for paving or for other kinds of uses rather than burning it? When you burn it, you're moving the pollution from a landfill to the air. So you're still having the pollution. It's just a case of where it's going.
Yeah, and eventually it falls down everywhere else.
Yeah. And to make the reuse of tires successful, you actually have to redesign the tire so that it doesn't contain quite as complex a mixture of components and of chemicals and minerals that can then produce the sorts of toxins we don't want to see in our environment. So what we're facing is the possibility that we need to really redesign the way we produce goods, the way we package them, the way we dispose of things. And it's a much bigger systemic change than we're really prepared to take on just yet, I think.
So these local actions from grassroots activists and people who are directly impacted, so to speak, on the ground, seem to be quite effective at times in diverting public policy in a way that can at least ameliorate the immediate condition. But I think the point that you're bringing up is that these are system, like architecture design issues with our global you know, right. economy and marketplace and general society at scale.
Even something like banning plastic bags, single-use plastic bags, that's one way to reduce garbage right away. Right? Using compostable packaging is another way to reduce garbage, because if it can be turned into good soil material, you can put it into a composting system that then becomes much more usable without a lot of environmental impact. So you're looking at a very basic redesign of the way we develop and circulate the products that we like to buy and use. There's also a very important factor is that China has stopped taking a lot of the recycling that we were producing. And one of the reasons they stopped taking it was that it was very contaminated. We weren't very good about separating what can be recycled from what cannot be recycled. So they said, we're tired of this rubbish that you're sending us. You know, we can't spend all our time sorting out your rubbish. You know, can you at least send us uncontaminated garbage that we can recycle in our petrochemical plants or wherever else it is? So that means that we have to maybe be inconvenienced in our households and start sorting our trash a lot more conscientiously than we have been up until now.
Yeah, it sounds as if we need to essentially have some level of compulsory recycling with guidelines and potentially even, I don't know, work that into like elementary school education in terms of how, you know, to properly rinse out a peanut butter container so that it can be properly recycled or what have you.
All of that's true. I also read something recently that said by putting a fee on every bag of garbage you put out on your front step, that reduced the amount of garbage that was produced every week dramatically.
Mm. Well, we have a local councilwoman, I don't know if you heard the headlines earlier, that is actually, we have a fee in Troy for the homeowners.
Well done.
There's already resistance against it. And I understand, as somebody who doesn't like to pay for things, why people are resistant to it. But I think the problems that you're bringing up here are very worth engaging with on a both local level as well as a much more large scale level.
Yeah, I think also when you're faced with people's likely resistance to these things, you have to think carefully about how does something get introduced? Who's consulted? What's the nature of the consultation? How well do people understand the choices that our policymakers are facing? We sort of expect them to solve the problem for us. And then when they present us with a solution, we say, but that's not the one we wanted. So we're being unreasonable in what we expect of policymakers. So what is the political process where people are actually given the choices, given some idea of, well, would you rather have this or would you rather have that? Mm-hmm. And we're not often being asked to make judgments. We're just being asked to comment or complain or
comply.
Or comply. So we have to be realistic as well with ourselves about what we're asking of our policymakers.
Do you happen to have any idea of what is happening to the recycling that is being rejected by China?
So
as far as I understand, no. They keep picking it up at my curb. So I've been recently personally interested in knowing where it's going and what's happening to it.
That's a very good question. I have no idea where it's going. I have read that some of it is going to countries that are more willing to take it. So instead of it going to China, it's now going to Thailand, Vietnam,
Bangladesh,
Cambodia, places that have less strict control over their management of imported waste. Mm. I've also read articles about recycling electronic waste in Kenya, where you'll get a little shack someplace near the coast, near the Mombasa port, where somebody's just taking these things apart, his workers are exposed to all sorts of chemicals without any protection at all. There's all sorts of leakage of things that nobody is looking at. So you get a poorer standard of environmental care when you just ship it to a country that doesn't have the standards that we do. So we put it overseas and say we've solved our problem. We haven't solved it. We've just given it to somebody else who might not be as equipped to handle it.
Yeah, essentially, what I'm taking away from this is the importance of recognizing that there's no out when people say, oh, I threw it out. Really, there's just a there.
There's no out. You're right. It's a good way to put it. It stays in the system somewhere.
Well, thank you very much, Barbara.
Thank you, Barbara.
You're very welcome.
Is there anything else you'd like to say to the listeners who may want to further get involved in either this action or in actions similar?
There's a number of issues in Queemans right now, and we have a very important election coming up. One of the other businesses that was very much in favor of burning tires has put up a slate of candidates to run for the town board. And I think anybody who's interested in local politics in Queemans should look very carefully at what those connections are between those candidates and the existing business interests in Queemans.
Well, thank you for that advisement and for your very careful verbiage there.
You're most welcome.
We encourage all of our listeners to engage in their civic duties and to be as informed as possible when voting is on the line.
Definitely.
Thank you very much.
Thanks again.
Thank you.
And that was Barbara Heinzen, environmental activist from New Baltimore, New York, speaking to us today about the town of Queemans, local law number 1 clean air bill. Listeners who want to join with Barbara and the community in support of this bill can attend the Queemans Town Board meeting at 7 p.m. this Thursday, March 14th. The meeting will be held at 18 Russell Avenue in Ravenna, New York, and you can email fellow activist Christine Primomo at christineprimomo2@gmail.com for more information. That's christineprimomo2@gmail.com. Thanks for joining us, Barbara.
Thank you for having me.
For those just tuning in, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network, coming to you from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Truro, New York.
To learn more about this program and the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or warm regards, email us, hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Our cover of the proposed Climate and Community Protection Act continues with a variety of ways legislators could go further to address climate change. We include the testimony of a member of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change.
Welcome back to our last segment covering the Climate and Community Protection Act public hearing, which took place on February 12th. 34 of the 38 witnesses who testified at the hearing spoke in support of climate legislation, and many asked that the bill be expanded to address even more methods of carbon reduction and climate mitigation than it does as written. There were many passionate testimonies. At one point, a witness held a photo of their young child and tearfully asked the committee what kind of world the children of today will inherit. Many witnesses overlapped in their recommendations. We've included several in this segment, starting with the direct testimony of a member of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change.
As I mentioned, my name is Matthias Vuy. I'm a professor and climate scientist in the Department of Atmospheric and Environmental Sciences at the University of Albany, and I'm a member of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC. Our climate is changing, and this change is driven by increasing concentrations of greenhouse gases in our atmosphere, gases that are emitted first and foremost through burning of fossil fuels. The evidence for this is unequivocal, as stated by all major national and international organizations, including the IPCC. As a result of our emissions, our planet is warming both in the ocean and in the air. The last 5 years have been the 5 warmest years since record-keeping began in the 19th century. 18 out of the 19 last warmest years have occurred since 2001. In New York State, perhaps the most significant impact from a changing climate we are already seeing is the clear increase in intense storms. Heavy precipitation events have increased in frequency in the Northeast more than in any other region in the United States. It is difficult to attribute a single event, such as Hurricane Sandy or Hurricane Irene, to climate change. But these storms now form an environment that is very different from what it was 50 or 100 years ago. The oceans are warmer, adding more energy to these storms. The air is warmer, allowing it to hold more moisture, thereby making rainfall more intense. And of course, sea level is higher, thereby increasing the storm surge. In fact, sea level has been rising throughout the 20th century and is currently rising by about 3.2 millimeters every year. This rise is caused by the warming of the ocean, leading to its expansion, and the added mass due to ice melt from glaciers and ice sheets in Greenland and West Antarctica. But sea level rise is not equal everywhere, and the mid-Atlantic and New England coasts are seeing a sea level rise that is much larger than the global average. Along the coast of New York, sea level rose by about 280 millimeters during the 20th century, compared to the global average of only about 170 millimeters. We are seeing changes in ecosystems in New York State that are clearly linked to climate change. Earlier flowering and greening of plants, northward migration of species, including birds, overwintering further north, marine species moving north or towards greater depths in the ocean in search for colder waters. We have seen an increase in Lyme disease in the United States, and studies in the Northeast have linked the earlier occurrence of the first Lyme disease cases in spring to warmer spring temperatures and earlier tick activity. Lakes and rivers in New York State now freeze over later in the fall, and their ice breaks up earlier in the spring than it did 50 years ago. We have seen a decrease in spring snow cover, which, together with warmer nighttime temperatures, may threaten the economic viability of ski resorts in New York State in decades to come. All of these changes are based on biologic and physical responses in our environment to a changing climate. They are objectively observable, measurable, regardless of political viewpoints. And I will end with this statement. The CO2 concentration in our atmosphere today is higher than it has been in at least 2.4 million years at the end of the Pliocene, long before humans walked this planet. We are increasing this concentration steadily year by year, thereby rapidly increasing our Earth's temperature. We have started an experiment with our planet without considering what the impacts will be and without realizing that some of these impacts will be with us for centuries or millennia. Whether we like it or not, we now have little choice but to try to mitigate climate change and at the same time adapt to its impacts.
I am here on behalf of Audubon New York. In the absence of federal action, we are really heartened by New York State's leadership in addressing climate change with the urgency that it really deserves. Developing a successful mitigation strategy will require us to examine every sector of our economy to see where we can reduce, neutralize, or eliminate carbon emissions. But of equal importance is going to be looking where we can, to where we can offset those emissions through natural climate solutions such as carbon sequestration. These offsets must be included in New York State's strategy to combat climate change. And we are fortunate in that these strategies have a two-for-one benefit. They also have the added benefit of creating habitat for wildlife. Protecting and restoring coastlines, especially salt marshes and other wetlands around Long Island, will increase climate resiliency and support vulnerable populations of coastal birds. The natural processes that protect those communities have degraded over the years. The sand and sediment is not being replenished, and instead that's being replaced by hard infrastructure. We would strongly encourage the state, as it directs the Department of Environmental Conservation through the Climate and Community Protection Act, to consider green infrastructure as part of its response to climate change.
So we have Kevin Schlad.
Any serious effort to fight climate change will include a dedicated carbon sequestration program.
My name's Constantine. Since 1999, I've worked for NYSERDA. It's extremely difficult to make substantive changes. A real challenge here is to focus on the elimination of pure waste while preserving lifestyle choices.
My name is Susan Keister. I'm the president of Keister Consulting, Inc., a forestry and environmental resource management consulting firm. Forests are an important part. We feel that that's not really been addressed completely in the legislation as presented. Cost of owning land is a big problem. So in my business, I see people not doing sustainable practices in forestry because of the tax bill that comes along, and they have to cut in order to pay their taxes. So things that could happen at the legislative level would be to work to create markets for low-grade woods so that people can afford to stay in their properties through the marketplace, or provide government subsidies and grants and programs to help get that forest management work done. Also helping the rural landowner stay on the farm, not subdivide it into smaller parcels that we can't.
My name is Catherine Natto. I'm the deputy director at Catskill Mountain Keeper. With warmer winters, we're seeing the spread of invasive species that could decimate the forest and threaten the watershed. We see more variable and higher temperatures that are threatening vegetable growth, and climate change may threaten the availability and price of livestock feed.
So my name's Liz Moran. I'm the Environmental Policy Director for NYPERG, the New York Public Interest Research Group. New York State's seen 2 degrees average warming since 1970, 4 degrees for winter, and there are environmental justice impacts that we're experiencing right now. Increased precipitation is leading to a lot of sewage overflows in our water bodies. Billions of gallons of sewage annually are discharged into our waterways. And we don't talk about it this way that often, but climate change is a public health crisis. As written, there may not be new action on climate until 2025, so we have a specific proposal to have a fast-track panel, which would which could remedy this. It can convene shortly after enactment. It could have recommendations that would take place over the next 5 years. At the end of the day, we've advanced technology tremendously just in the past year. We can't wait for technology to be perfect. We need action as urgently as possible. And I think that's where everyone agrees today, that climate change requires urgent action. But we need to make sure that this legislation reflects that urgency.
Changes that we can make. Looking to where the governor is and looking where this bill is, we need to be more ambitious. We need to look at goals. How can we get 1 million households across New York to have solar on their roofs? How can we get 100,000 acres of solar farms? Those are some of the ambitious targets we need to look at. We need to broaden beyond just the energy sector to look at residential and commercial buildings, to look at transportation. We need to look at an array of energy efficiency standards. There's a lot of conservation goals that could be achieved, but we need to find a way that the wasteful carbon activities in the state are made to pay for the solutions at hand.
My name's Constantine. Since 1999, I've worked for NYSERDA. The easiest way to solve this entire issue is to have the gas and electric utilities use EPA benchmarking to create a sliding utility rate bias that rewards efficient facilities and penalizes poor performers.
My name is Daniel Gotti. I'm a senior transportation analyst at the Union of Concerned Scientists. So, you know, we need to be doing a lot more on vehicle electrification to make these vehicles affordable for more people, to make these vehicles affordable for the poor and for poor transit agencies as well, right, to be able to electrify as much of our transportation system as quickly as we can. If you want to operationalize a limit on climate emissions, honestly, here's how you do it. You set a cap. You have that cap decline every year. You require polluters to purchase allowances under that cap because you limit the number of allowances available, you limit the amount of emissions that are acceptable in the state, and as a result, you generate a whole bunch of money from these allowance sales that you can then use as a basis for your investments in clean transportation and clean energy technologies that are ultimately going to save consumers money.
We can't afford to kick this can down the road. The only thing stopping us is political will.
These 34 witnesses who testified at this hearing in favor of climate legislation asked that the committee broaden the scope of the CCPA to include many other kinds of solutions, including market-based emission regulations and biomass energy solutions. An overarching theme was sustainable land management, solutions like helping landowners afford to keep their parcels intact to prevent land from becoming subdivided, and giving landowners resources to sustainably manage their forests are just a couple of ways the bill could go further to sequester carbon. The bottom line is this: if we want to address climate change, legislators need to have the political backbone. The public support is there. If you have an idea, a response to these testimonies, or you want to show your support for or against this bill, contact your senator and assemblyperson. The Senate allows 120 days from the hearing for the submission of public comment, and you can read the bill in full at nysenate.gov. For Hudson Mohawk Magazine, I'm Alexis Goldsmith.
And that was Alexis Goldsmith with coverage of the public hearing on the proposed Climate and Community Protection Act. Thank you, Alexis.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM Troy and WOOS 98.9 FM Schenectady. Iconic Capital Region musician and host Caroline Isaacson has died. Isaacson, who was known by her stage name, Mother Judge, had told an audience in January that she was battling pancreatic cancer. Isaacson hosted what was often known as the best damn open mic ever for more than two decades at various Albany bars. We offer this 2010 recording of Isaacson performing live at the Sanctuary for Independent Media as tribute.
Leaves are falling just like embers in colors red and gold. They set us on fire, burning like moonbeams in our eyes. Somebody said they saw me swinging the world by the tail, bouncing over the white clouds, killing the blue. I'm guilty of something. I hope you never do, because there is nothing sadder than losing yourself in love.
That was Caroline Mother Judge Isaacson performing Killing the Blues live at the Sanctuary for Independent Media on June 11th, 2010. The original song was by Roland Sally. And that concludes our show. We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Chris Scully.
And I'm Amy Loria. Our engineer tonight is Alexis Goldsmith. Remember to tune back in tomorrow and every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get that dose on demand through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page. If you have comments, suggestions, or a tender confession, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Also, be sure to tune in 7 to 10 p.m. weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, a wonderful celebration of all that is creative, dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region.
As a reminder, the Hudson Mohawk Magazine is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in helping with our radio effort, shoot us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org. Or just stop by at one of our weekly meetings on Monday nights at 7:07 p.m., held right here at the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.
That was a pleasure.